Now, we're returning to one of the biggies now to kick us off in this hour, issues of trust within our democracy and how much it determines whether the political centre will hold. You've told us you care a great deal about the state of our democratic politics after a couple of our earlier interviews. And as you know, many gloomy perspectives prevail at the moment, suggesting both trust and democracy are in serious decline. Shortly, I'll welcome two younger researchers who've been thinking long and hard about this from different perspectives. They might even say that all those protesters at the G20 summit this week at least show vital engagement, whether or not we like the method, and obviously we don't in many ways, but apathy is a genuine concern if we're measuring democracy's health. First, we're rejoined, though, by a seasoned contributor, the former editor of The Economist, Bill Emmett, who believes we can't avert our gaze from the central role played by the GFC in this issue. We do have choices right now, he believes, to not just despair, to roll up our sleeves and intervene in democracy's future life. And I'm delighted he could speak to me late yesterday about some of his conclusions.
Great to be with you again.
Why have you stressed in this book with the great name, The Fate of the West, the battle to save the world's most successful political idea, why have you stressed openness and equality as the two sort of key motifs of our system?
That's really the triumph of liberalism, the openness that allows the fruit of humankind to come forth. But it needs to be blended with a sense of equality of participation as citizens, in order that when there are stiff, bracing winds of change, when there are difficulties, when there's social dysfunction, we at least trust each other enough that we think we can get over it rather than having a civil war or some other form of conflict. And that balance between the equality that you get in a open democratic society as a citizen with a vote, with access to free education, with measures by government to support you if you're less able than others, that has been vital to us being able to sustain our bracing open model decade after decade, turbulence after turbulence. But I think we've lost some of the equality side of that, at least in Europe and the United States.
So this question of trust, which seems to emerge a lot, this word, I know a lot of people say, well, what do you really mean when you talk about trust and democracy? What do you mean?
I mean a basic faith that working within the system is going to be the right way to change things rather than having a revolution or a war or huffing off and going somewhere else. I mean a basic faith in the system that also leads you to believe that in the face of the law, we'll be more or less equal. So it's that sort of trust. It varies between countries. The country I've written a lot about in recent years, Italy, is a country famously with quite low trust, where nobody trusts the government and everyone tries to game the system. Somewhere like Sweden is a country with very high trust, where people assume good behavior until proven otherwise. So we vary.
How do you unshackle this whole notion of equality from socialism, though? Because you say that they're not one and the same.
I think that it's not about just about income equality. Income equality, of course, matters because, as we are taught when we're students, you know, one of the basic things is freedom's all very well, but it's the freedom to go and drink a bottle of champagne and stay at the Ritz, only if you can afford it. So income matters. but basically...
Spoken like a true former editor of The Economist.
There you are, exactly. That's right. I'll open another bottle of champagne. I think that the equality that really matters is equality of opportunity, of social mobility, of the sense that you may not be well off, but your children could do better. Your children can get a good education. Your children can get a good job. Your children have a chance to rise to the highest levels in society. And it's that openness of opportunity that equality needs to provide, which comes with also a sense that your vote is equal to that of your neighbors and of everyone else's, rather than some people buying politics through their billions of campaign contributions.
Well, beautiful segue for me, because is the average person's vote worth that of the banks? You make it quite plain that the banks' maximized risk and minimise the responsibility by relying on a massive public safety net? In other words, would we be even having these whole conversations that seem to be so gripping us if it weren't for the global financial crisis and subsequent bank behaviour, do you say?
I believe the financial crisis was absolutely central, and the consequences of which are Donald Trump and other ructions to the system, including Brexit in my own country. And that's because it broke a great sense of fairness and justice in the system, as well as leading people to basically have falling incomes for a decade, which has really not changed. But also it was an example of how interest groups, powerful interest groups, can get a disproportionate hold over public policy. We all know this happens all the time to some degree. You know, the big companies are always going to be more influential than small ones. But the question is, how disproportionate is that hold? Do they really distort public policy year after year in a way that then causes damage? I believe they did. I believe that in the 20 years running up to 2008, they got such a power that regulations were reduced to a dangerous level, that central banks and regulators turned a blind eye, that they were allowed to go on betting more and more, essentially using the safety net of our taxpayers' money. And we didn't really notice what was going on at the time, but it represented their grip over democracy. It's not the only example of the way this can happen, but it was a massive and damaging one that needs to be remedied.
When was the last time we were this gloomy? You do make some very interesting observations about comments that were made in the 60s by, say, Willy Brandt.
Yes, I think that we were very gloomy in the 60s and 70s, particularly in the 70s. That was when I was a student, and I think many of us graduating in England the late 70s and then entering the job market in the early Thatcher period thought that we would never get a job. We were pretty browned off with the system. I think then we had high inflation. We had a sense that the rug was being pulled under us by oil prices shooting up. There was a kind of sense that commodities were never going to be cheap again. The Club of Rome told us we were running out of resources. Our democracies seemed not to be working very well. And politics seemed to have gone somewhat against us with ultimately the Iranian Revolution, but also the Arab oil embargo and so forth. And we got very gloomy. And that's why Willy Brandt said, in his late years as Chancellor of West Germany, he said he thought that in Western Europe, democracy only had another 20 or 30 years to survive, and after that we would sink into the swamp of dictatorship that surrounded us. Fortunately, his predictions were wrong. At least they were wrong, assuming that you think that democracy is going to continue to carry on. We're 40 years on from when he said that.
No.
So he was certainly on the dates.
I want to finish with how we fight back, including, may I say, your emphasis on restoring a civility to our lives. Why did you emphasise that?
Well, I think that citizenship and the sense of equal participation requires some sense of the moral things that bind us together, the things that say, yes, you should obey the law, but also you have some interest in the welfare of your fellow man and woman. And I think that, and this is something you might be surprised to hear a former editor of The Economist say, I think that the dog-eat-dog atmosphere of the sort of go-go years of the 90s and 2000s in many of our societies led to something of a move away from that. But overall, I think that we, in our governments and our political discourse, need to re-emphasize equality, put a greater priority on things that build social mobility and deal with problems of adjustment to change in technology and trade that parts of our societies suffer from.
I wonder if it means that unions must have to revive as well.
Well, I think that we may have gone too far in loss of unions. I definitely think it varies from society to society, but I definitely think that we need to get minimum wages rising higher, because the way in which wages at the bottom end of the skill scale have fallen in real terms over many years is causing a lot of our problems of a sense of inequality, but also of very weak household demand, of alienation at that end of the labor market. And what can governments do? Yes, they could give unions greater powers, but probably what the most direct thing they can do is raise those statutory minimum wages to at least flatten the curve a little bit.
Well, this has been a big debate.
Help people at the bottom.
A big debate here in Australia, and our Reserve Bank governor was making very similar remarks, particularly about wages. Bill Emmett, thank you very much indeed for your time.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you again, Geraldine.
That's Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist, author of The Fate of the West, The Battle to Save the World's Most Successful Political Idea. It's just published by Economist Books, not yet available in all countries, including us here. Well, now for some different perspectives, and I'd like to introduce two people now who've been listening along with us all. Dr. Roberto Foer joins us from London, though he's normally a lecturer in political science at Melbourne University. Roberto and a Harvard colleague, Yasha Monk, have been evaluating international data about people's attitudes to democracy in the World Values Survey, and they've drawn some pretty challenging conclusions about where things might be heading. And their survey has been creating a lot of interest. And with me in Australia is Rachel Botsman. Rachel's an author and commentator who specialises in ideas about the vital but changing attitudes to trust. Hello there.
Hi, good to be here.
I'm interested to hear, first of all, what you both make of some of Bill Emmett's points. First of all, his depiction of trust in the political sense. He said it's a basic faith that working within the system is going to be the right thing rather than having a revolution or a war, or leaving the country, basically. Now, Roberto, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I would. I mean, I would say that trust is a coin with two sides. There's trust and there's trustworthiness. And in the context of a democracy, that means both the confidence that the citizens have that by participating in elections, by joining political parties, by trying to influence politics, their voice will be heard. And on the flip side, there's the trustworthiness of politicians and the political elite to actually take on board the views and preferences of their constituents, rather than being swayed by special interests or other kinds of influence that may affect the policy process. So I think that, you know, in Western democracies, we've had a decline, certainly in political trust and perhaps also in trustworthiness of political elites. And that's something that needs to change.
In a way, you need trust of your citizens to believe that the welfare system will work for them and won't be gamed.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Roberto that trust is a form of currency, but in a democracy, you have to have confidence in the system itself. So the legal system, the financial system, the healthcare system, the voting system, and then you have to have faith in the people leading those systems. And I think why we're in a unique moment in time and in a real trust crisis is we're seeing this confluence of a lack of faith in both the leadership, the trustworthiness of the people, and how well the systems work as well. And a lot of the erosion of faith has come from a misalignment of intentions. So actually saying, do I trust the integrity and the intentions of the people in charge of these systems? And will they hold people accountable if they break my trust? You know, survey after survey is showing the same thing, that trust in institutions, whether it be in churches, in charities, in the media, in governments, in banks, is at a historic low around the world.
So it's quite interesting whether there's an element of retribution in what you're talking about, Rachel, that in order for people to feel that they can trust, dare I put it like this, they have to be capable of saying there'll be retribution if necessary. It's not a nice word, retribution. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes and no, but I mean, I think a lot of the times when we talk about trust breaking down, trust didn't exist in the first place. So I find it really interesting that a lot of the conversation is what do we do when we lose trust, or how do we find a way through when there wasn't an existence, there wasn't a basis of trust. Mm. And that's why I think a lot of the conversation tends to be on the penalties and the consequences.
Or retribution as blame. You know, I want to blame somebody and I want someone to pay with their job or their salary.
But I think it actually starts, I want someone to be accountable. I want someone to care. I want to hear a response. I want to hear empathy.
And that's so individualistic, you know, and subjective, isn't it?
It is. But when people don't hear that, that's when it turns to anger. And that's when it becomes like this virulent virus that just spreads through the system. And that's the precarious and dangerous place to be, because you have this vacuum where you see things like Trump and Brexit, where ironically, trust is trumping the truth.
And see, you know, Roberto, Bill Emmett also said when there are big changes and social dysfunction flowing, we have to trust each other to get over it. I agree with him. Do you?
I think very often the opposite happens in times of great change like those that we're living through now, that trust is something that's very, takes a long time to build up, but is very easy to break down, as it has broken down quite sharply in Western democracies in the last 10 to 15 years or so. And then when that happens, I mean, it creates a space where, you know, when nobody feels that they can trust in anyone, they don't feel that they can trust in established politicians, established politics, political parties, even the media. And it creates this sort of very hyper-cynical space where suddenly anti-establishment politicians can come in and succeed because people are willing, in a way, to trust someone who's completely outside the system, who says, I'm going to, you know, drain the swamp, I'm going to change the system, shake things up, rock the cradle.
So it's a sort of susceptibility that those type of people, demagogues, exploit.
Yes. And it makes it very difficult for citizens to achieve reform through the established institutions, because citizens have become critical not only of politicians who may be unreliable or underperforming, but also those who are genuinely passionate for and dedicated to the public good. Mm. And likewise, in the media space, citizens become ready to entertain any kind of negative news, no matter how poorly sourced or spurious it may be. Ironically, only further reinforcing this kind of cycle of cynicism and mistrust.
I just want to read a letter that we got from one of our listeners, Donald Richardson, after our recent interviews that we've been doing around this issue. And he asked me to look at an article by Rob Garland in the June the 21st issue of The Guardian, not the international newspaper, he said, but the bi-weekly of the Communist Party of Australia. And it commences, "The form of government that capitalism finds most congenial is bourgeois democracy. By staging elections every few years, the people are given the erroneous impression that they, and not the owners of the big corporations, decide the government and run the country." Now, Rachel, you know, that is a very particular ideological approach. Are elections themselves, in your view, do they augment trust or not?
I mean, I think the election cycle, the voting process is so different. So I've spent an extensive period of time in the United States. I came from London. I now live here. And I think voting being optional actually creates a different relationship to the election cycle. So, you know, I don't think it is all doom and gloom. I think the fact that, not that I agree with Jeremy Corbyn, but the fact that he could get young people out and mobilize the vote. You do Bernie Sanders, you do see people who come along and they touch something, right? It's really hard to define, and they mobilize people. But what I think is interesting in Australia is, because you have to vote, it's the law to vote, I'm not sure that people really place a value on it. It feels like something that you're obliged to do.
I could take you up on that as an Australian, because I actually think it forces people to buy in, and that it actually does engage people. They have to slightly lay aside their cynicism, but I suppose we could debate that from now. I mean, you talk, for instance, Rachel, I want to get to both of your specific work, about this move away from institutional trust, which I suppose is a continuation of what you've just said then, towards a new kind of trust, what you call distributed trust. Now, what do you mean?
So what I mean is, if you think of institutions and the type of trust that they depend on, it's often flows upwards, right? So it flows upwards to gatekeepers and regulators and authorities. It's highly centralized, it's highly hierarchical, and it's bureaucratic. And what I think is happening is that it's breaking down because it wasn't designed for the digital age. So it's not just a generational thing. When people hit against these institutional mechanisms, so whether it is a voting system or whether it is Medicare, these systems aren't designed in a way that they can really relate to. And what's happening is, rather than trust flowing down from institutions, we're starting it to see flow sideways to individuals. So surveys are showing that you trust the person on the bus more than an expert or more than a leader or a politician. So you're seeing this inversion of influence. Now, on one side of that, that is incredibly dangerous, right? That we're listening to all these different voices. And as Roberto said, it gives rise to people that really understand how to appeal to your feelings versus fact. But on the other side, it's not necessarily a bad thing that influence no longer comes from a top-down fashion. It opens democracy up to hearing more voices that can actually influence people's opinions.
And Roberto, you have come to some, you and your colleague have come to some very disturbing conclusions about a breakdown of the intergenerational sort of covenant about democracy, you think that there is a readiness among younger voters in the Western world for authoritarian solutions?
I wouldn't go.
Is that too strong?
I think that's a little bit too strong. I mean, what I would say is that there's a disillusionment, apathy, disillusionment, sometimes disgust with the functioning of democracy among younger voters in Western countries. And we see that quite clearly in the survey data that, you know, younger respondents in the United States, in the UK, also in Australia, tend to certainly be a great deal less enthusiastic about democracy.
Well, you said political apathy. Yeah. You said there's a real growth in political apathy.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And that you do wonder whether there's an genuine indifference there or whether they've never experienced a real threat. I thought that was a very interesting distinction you made.
Yeah, certainly that's maybe part of the intergenerational difference. But I do fear that part of the democratic disconnect is also based on experience, that we have actually had these kind of waves where young people have got mobilized in particular points in time into politics. There was great enthusiasm during the Obama campaign in 2008. Actually, in France, it's now forgotten that there were young people who were very enthused by François Hollande's election in 2012. But then when politicians come in, you know, the enthusiasm fades. People see that, change is, if not impossible, certainly more difficult to bring about than had been initially hoped, that some of the structural problems in the political system relating to the power of special interests, or the inability to get certain kinds of, in those cases, progressive changes through, reveals itself. And as a result, young people have become, in some cases, more cynical and disillusioned.
Interestingly, neither of you, you can both tell me if I'm wrong, talk about utopianism. Like, are you finding that people are tilting at windmills that really were never tilted at by previous generations, or that they're looking for extremely good operational abilities of these systems, which previous generations didn't even expect? And so they're disproportionately disappointed, Rachel.
I think they're looking for a clear ideology. They're looking for a clear voice. They're looking for people that have an opinion. And so what cuts through what you're seeing in campaigns is people that feel like they're away from the establishment. They don't feel lukewarm. They don't feel like they're just representing an old form of politics. So I don't know if that's, I don't think it's utopian. I think it's just, it's people that feel like they can turn the page. And to go back to what Roberto said, it's often this promise that it's not just about their politics, it's that they will structurally change the system. And I thought it was really interesting. I watched this interview with Obama recently, and it was very telling. They were asking him about his greatest disappointment. It was that he couldn't change anything structurally around the way politics works. And I think that's the ideology people fall in love with, is that someone can come along and they actually have the power to change the system.
Well, Roberto, your thoughts on that, given the work that you've done?
Sure. I mean, I think that utopianism is something that is valuable. It's important to believe in a better tomorrow and a better future. And I think that if we went back in time in Western democracies 20, 30, well, perhaps more 30 to 40 or 50 years ago, there was a kind of, if you will, a utopian imaginary, a belief that together as a society, we could create a better future for ourselves. I think that
and we did, didn't we?
Has been lost.
And we did.
And we did. It did. and that happened, which is a wonderful thing.
I mean, this is post-World War II, yeah. You know, with the entire Europe laid waste. And I mean, nothing like that has quite occurred in Western Europe anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there was a point in time for Western democracies when we overcame this lack of trust, that there was this, obviously for World War II was a great mobilizing effort. It was a belief in collective action and citizenship, and afterwards an acceptance among all groups in society, rich and poor, that, you know, by making a contribution, one could build a better system for everyone. And that's been lost, and that's clearly eroded over the last 20 to 30 years, both at the level of ideas and also in terms of the reality and the economic reality of the society in which we live.
Now, I'm going to ask you both, is democracy as stable now as it was in the past, Rachel?
No. So I think in terms of, you've got to break that down in terms of the democratic system itself and how well those mechanisms are working. And I think they're failing us. And then the ideals that we were talking about, which I think still exist. I think people are still hungry for them. The potential is still there, but that we radically need to change the system, that the way the political system is set up, again, it just was not designed for the digital age. And I think that is part of the problem, is that when you look at many of the ideas around reinvention, they're still stuck in an old institutional system. But I do think this is a time of opportunity. I think it's so easy to get stuck in this conversation about trust in crisis. And, you know, it's like Picasso said, the first act of creation is destruction. And so what I want to see happen is that we use this anger, we use this angst, we use this fear, and rather, you know, trying to patchwork democracy, we actually really try to redesign and rebuild our systems.
Roberto.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that and also Bill Emmett's remarks that, you know, that there have been recurrent crises of democracy. There was a crisis of faith in democracy that was very deep in the 1970s. And particular countries have had their particular crises at different points in time.
When it has felt very unstable and regrouped.
And it's been contingent. I think that we've been quite lucky in the West that when we have had these moments of crises, they've resolved in a positive way. That, you know, American democracy was reborn in the 1930s and 40s under Roosevelt. You know, French democracy was reborn under de Gaulle with the Fifth Republic. So that we've had these moments of crises and we've sort of pulled out of them. We've managed to avoid the scenario that other countries, for example, in Latin America or other transitional and emerging democracies have faced, where they've ended up taking quite a different road. So there's absolutely every reason to be positive and to think that we can get out of this current malaise of democracy. But we just have to avoid being too complacent and assuming that's going to happen.
Just to echo something Bill Emmett said, the other thing is that we need leaders that focus on social cohesion. So when you look at countries and nations that have recovered from a trust crisis, it's when people are bound together, we're reminded of our similarities. And when you have leaders that are hammering out our differences, that adds to how precarious the situation is.
A common project. Yeah. And hope, I would have thought. Neither of you have mentioned hope, because I would have thought that a society without hope is hopeless. And it's pretty important. But maybe we'll have to take this up and ask the media how they feel, how they're positioned in the middle of all of this. Look, I thank you very much indeed, Rachel Botsman and Roberta Foer. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Roberto has published several reports with Harvard scholar Yasha Monk on a large international survey, the value survey they've done on attitudes to democracy. It's very thought-provoking. I must say, we'll have a link to the latest on our website. He's a lecturer in political science at Melbourne University. And Rachel Botsman writes widely on issues of trust, and you might like to follow her as well. And I noticed one of our people who've texted us said, the city of Botany, Geraldine, asked us to vote if we want to amalgamate with Rockdale. 97% of us said no, but it had no meaning. Where was democracy then? That's Ruth. Yes, well, many of you may have thoughts. I love to hear them.